perfect stuff of beer or a cold libation. Let me tell you how I wrote this little theme. I went and took a call from Brother Jason, and he tells me that he has a little dream. He says he needs a backwards intro to begin his podcast, and I ask him, what you got? He said, I'll start off with some talking and some movie clips of popcorn fighting, fantasy explorations and some groundless exploitation, kickstarts that I'm watching and some blind unboxing, school month or a movie marathon. Sometimes I let the dogs come on, contest and of course you know it's all about games. That's a slogan, let's just start with the name. It's the Nerds RPG Variety Podcast. With the other Jason.
Welcome back to Nerds RPG Variety Cast. This is a special episode. I have a special guest joining me, and we're going to talk about solo RPGs and maybe some just discussion of different systems out there, different ways to play. And as somebody that's just getting into solo stuff myself, I thought, why not go to the master? And when I say master, when I think of solo RPGs, I'm thinking of it as I'm playing at home and what I'm going to do at home. I'm not worried about putting a product out to somebody else. And I am doing a blog right now where I'm publishing some of the thing, some of my ventures. But for the most part, I'm looking at what we're going to do as a player at home. So while things like Me, Myself, and Di are great, that's not necessarily what you're going to do when you're sitting at home. The closest show I found to that is Subclass Act. So I asked James to join me today to enlighten us about solo RPGs and playing solo. James, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Jason. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. So, yeah. How do we play solo? Where do we start?
Yeah, I know. This is one of those things where it's one of those ones where there's unsatisfying answers, because unlike other games, you know, there's a balance between the, you know, whatever works for you, which is no answer at all, and, you know, this exact, here's how you start. You do A, B, and C. It's somewhere in between those two, which is unsatisfying. But for me, I think the biggest thing is, instead of thinking about, like, how do I solo play first, it'd be better, like, how do I play in general, or what do I want to play? And don't think about, like, well, I wouldn't start with, is the rule system ideal? Is my Oracle ideal? Because you can swap those things so much more easily than you can with a group game, because you don't have any other players to disappoint. So you can always start with something and then say, oh, I like this and I want to keep this action going, but I think maybe this will suit this better. And I've certainly done that on the show a lot, partly just to showcase different, sometimes to showcase different games, and sometimes just because whatever I'm playing does not go in the direction that I'm hoping that the action will go. And so I don't pre-plan it, but sometimes you're going to have different games that push you in different directions, right? And same with the Oracle. So I think, start with, like, all right, what sounds fun to play, or fun to GM. I think that's the other thing, is that there's two sides to this. Now, I've never been one who, there are some people who solo play by trying to be, instead of mostly the player, they try to be mostly the GM and use oracles to see what the players would do. I've not done that myself, but that's another angle. But the most important thing is, okay, what kind of game do I want to play, regardless of how suitable it is or not, based on what people say as far as soloing? What do I want to play? Start with that. And the oracles, if you don't already have an idea, I would say the two ways to start are you a person who prefers more structure or a person with less structure? And I'd say that there's different oracles for both of those. You know, some people like the more structured oracles, so they can write down the threads and everything like that and keep it tracked, more simulationist in that way. And for some people, it's more just like, hey, just roll a die and you assign different values. It could be just yes, no. It could be, you know, the easiest one is probably like, one is no, and then two is no, and then so on up to, you know, no, but, yes, yes, and. That's probably the easiest one if you want something lightweight. But I think those are the two things. What game do I want to play? And then do I want more or less structure?
Excellent.
For me, starting out, more structure was better, because I was still fairly new to playing RPGs in general, just the past year or two, really. At the time I started the first season, I was still really new, so I needed more structure in general, because I had no idea what I was doing at all, solo or otherwise. And then over time, I think I've removed some of the structure as I already have an implicit structure and it doesn't always align to the oracles. And it's nothing against the oracles, but it just doesn't align. And so I like the, I'm starting to gravitate in general towards the simpler ones now. Some people though know right off the bat that they're going to chafe against like the structure, in which case don't feel like you have to use the, you know, the in oracle, just like you don't have to play the in game, or you can, and that's fine too.
Excellent. Yeah. I think one, if people are, so we're going to talk about some different things here and we're not going to, even though I kind of launched off with a hard question, how do you start and what is solo role playing? we're not going to get super in depth. We're going to assume that people already have kind of a feeling out there, but if you're looking to read something more in depth, there's a blog out there called Tabletop Diversions. Now that is the blog of John Urios. And unfortunately, John hasn't put anything up for a number of years, but it's still out there. And there's a series on there, How to Play an RPG Solo. And there are a number of blog articles. I'll link in the show notes. It's a great place to go read if you're coming at this fresh. But I still think this conversation with James is going to be very helpful. But, you know, there's some very basic things that we probably won't cover that maybe you'll be able to pick up in some of this blog stuff. As far as having James here, one of the big things, what I love about Subclass Act is, like you say, you switch back and forth between systems, you try different things. And if somebody goes and listens to the whole show, all your seasons, they're going to get exposed to so many different ways to play solo, which is amazing. And one thing I wanted to ask you about, so when you started playing back in season one, you started with a group. You had a group of PCs. We started with fantasy and we had a group in the city. And then, early on there was a group in the city. It may not have been the very first thing, but it was pretty early on there. But since then, you gravitated towards playing just one PC in the games. So maybe we can talk a little bit about the complications, or I think it's natural, but if we're used to just regular RPGs with groups, it's natural to think, well, I need a group of PCs, especially if you're playing 5e or something. You're used to having that group where people have different roles. But playing a group of PCs solo is a lot more complicated than playing just one PC, especially when you're trying to get in the headspace of those characters.
Yes, that's what I found. Yeah, it's kind of funny. I totally forgot, actually, that I played with the group in season one. I think I blocked season one, just like everybody, like, you know, hopefully all the seasons got better. And so I think I blocked season one out of my mind. No, it's funny. I think that was and I remember now too, because that wasn't really even a fully conscious decision, because I had played a small amount of solo before deciding to start the show, but not a ton. But it's funny, I think back and I really liked those games I played before the show. But I think I pretty much only had individual characters when I did that. Partly because I think the very first solo thing I ever played was I was just sort of understanding OSR stuff, and I found there was but I was only in the periphery of it, and I found something that was like a solo adventure kind of thing. I was like, oh, this will lead me through it, and it happened to be for I think like the Pace Setter Games version of BX or whatever, and so I ended up buying the PDF of that to play it, and actually it was pretty fun. So but it was very structured, and then I had Basic Fantasy before I started recording the show, and I played a little bit of that, and that was fun. A little bit of 5e solo, but that was just one PC. And I think it was because at the very beginning of season one, I decided to be so random, and I rolled a d4 to see how many characters I'd have. Which, in hindsight, that was an overly bold move. it was kind of fun though. There is definitely something to be said about playing with the multiple characters, because I still think back and I can still remember some of the characters in my head. And it is a little bit hard to, I'll say though, when you're not recording, it's easier to pull that off. When you're recording, everything is much, much harder when I'm recording. For some reason, my IQ dips down like 100 points every time I get in front of the mic. I just forget everything. But it was interesting though, because there was some interplay between what the different characters would do. And they had different motivations. And so that certainly was interesting, but it was hard to keep track of. And yeah, that's mainly it. I think it was also that I thought, well, I don't want these characters to die immediately, and this is an OSR game. So I'll have multiple characters. And so what that means is that I had them die like right away. So I think some of them died pretty early, whatever. Yeah. Hopefully not spoilers for the first season, but people should start with season two anyway. But yeah, it is interesting, but it's nearly unmanageable unless you're using a lighter weight system. But I think that's something that would be interesting. I haven't thought about trying it, but it would be interesting with something like Tiny D6 or something that's already pretty light. It would be interesting having a party because the rules are minimal enough, but you get the complexity sort of and the emergent story from the different characters and the way that they interact and play. But if you want to try to play something like even like Savage Worlds, I think with more than one character for solo, at least if you're recording it, I think you're going to have a bad time. Or at least I would. I would not be able to do that.
Right. And so for me, solo play is I've got half an hour. I've got 2 hours of free time.
Right.
I'm going to sit down and try to play something. And so for that, it's one of those balancing. Do I need to have 5 books in front of me and go here and go right there and have character sheets? And do I need to have 3x5 cards with all their abilities out? You know, like if you're playing Pathfinder, a game like that, and your character's high level, if you don't have cheat sheets and spell cards and this and that, you're not going to remember what all your character can do. And to do that for multiple characters it's a chore. You know, it's like playing one of these big box board games.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It became unwieldy. And so that's why I'll say like, some of my favorite sessions on and off the mic have been with, I guess simpler rule sets, but I wouldn't necessarily say rules light, but simpler, at least in the sense that they can be smaller form factor. Like I have the white cover version of the Traveler sci-fi rules. That's all in one. It's the 3 black booklets, basically all with the errata smushed together. It's about the same size also as, White Box, White Box, Fantastic Media Level Adventure Game, which I think is also very, very good for that. It's some of my other favorite sessions to play, and they're very, very small in form factor. And so you can have that, you know, have a small Oracle and, or a couple small tables, like Perilous Wilds real close without having a bajillion books. And you can stick them in a backpack and you have a little notebook. You can have everything just right there. That's sort of what have been some of probably my favorite sessions, maybe an Oracle that's easy to internalize, but that you can reference more. That's why I would say, I still think one of the most underrated Oracles for that reason is, Motif. Because you can internalize the basic question, still get complex enough answers, I think, but it has stuff that you can add on to it. You can reference, you know, stuff about NPCs and these other things it has, but really just the basics of rolling the 3 dice, getting an answer and moving on and having it be interesting enough, I think. Yeah, that's the thing. So I wouldn't necessarily call White Box or Traveler rules light. So it doesn't have to be super, super rules light, but they wouldn't be rules heavy. But the most important thing for me was just that this small form factor, one small little book, everything's right there. And because you only got so many minutes, right, to sit down and play.
Right. And one last question on rules, because everybody's going to gravitate to what works for them.
Yeah.
And then I definitely want to dive into Oracles for most of this discussion, but can rules be too light? Because rules definitely help us with solo play in the structure, and depending how you play, like you were talking about at the beginning of our talk, you know, sometimes those more procedural games like say BX or OSE, having all those procedures, I mean, at that point you almost have a board game format, right? And that definitely helps, especially if you're just starting, having those procedures to go through, if you enjoy that sort of thing, definitely can help out because it guides you right through. Okay, well, it's time to do this. It's time to do that. It's time to do that. But can rules be too light? Have you come across rule systems that just didn't give you enough to really, you know, grasp?
I think probably. Or at least, you know, some people were saying, oh, you know, I didn't even use a rule system. I just used the Oracle, or trying to think of some of the most rules light stuff. Probably the most rules light one I've done maybe was Cairn. That was probably, but even that still worked, I think, because there were the Oracle that somebody made added some procedures. So at the end of the day, I think you have to view rule sets a little differently with solo, because it's really everything that you're using is the rule set. So you can kit bash as much as you want. So even if you have a somewhat rules light game, if you have a more complicated Oracle, or you simply have a more structured setting, fiction, whatever you want to call it, that has more back behind it, that I think can make up for a rules light setting. So I would say like it depends on how much guidance you need. So when I was playing Iron Sworn the first time, that was one of the really nice things about Iron Sworn is that the moves sort of move you into the next thing, kind of moves you along. And you know, it gives some structure to you when you don't know anything right at the beginning. So actually let's put it that way. I think season three really kind of answered this question for me and showed me the balance because it started out with Classic Traveler for the bulk of it. And then I moved on to some other rule sets, but I think, and some of my favorite sessions were with, what's it called? The Tiny D6 space, space game, which is great. I don't think I would have been able to successfully start the season with that game though. It's not that Tiny D6 is two rules light. It's that Traveler had a much more baked in setting and, you know, the tables and all that. And so the fiction, of the setting that it was building up, not fiction necessarily in like a story game kind of thing, but just the setting was building up over time because of Traveler and the conceits of Traveler. And that gave me more of a starting point than Tiny D6. And so I think that was more it than anything. I think that's the thing is that all the things that inspire you like that in the game are more important than even in a group game, I think. So, you know, just pouring through the books and just the artifact of the book itself matters a lot more, at least to me, in solo play than in group play, I think.
Right. And something we probably should have said at the very beginning of the podcast, solo play, well, it's very much an RPG. Don't feel like you're doing something wrong or anything else with solo play, but you can't approach solo play expecting to walk away with the same experience as you do with group play.
That's right. They
really are different, and you have to approach it with a different mindset because otherwise you will be disappointed.
It is a parallel hobby, I think. Mm-hmm. Because it's not quite like, you know, one of the other things I'm trying to get into separately, but I haven't had time to, you know, with four kids and stuff and being busy with that. But, I've been wanting to get into some wargaming kind of stuff too. And, you know, I think one of the things that really got me into that, and I forget who first recommended it. Maybe it was Taylor from Cleric's Wear Ringmail, but was mentioning the joy of wargaming. And I watched a whole bunch of joy of wargaming, and that's like the best YouTube channel ever. But I think that and solo wargaming, I suspect, is similar in a way that it's different. But I would say it seems like it's more similar to when you're playing both sides of the solo wargaming than solo role playing is to role playing. I think those are more different because specifically the role playing aspect. You have much more opportunity for input from multiple players that leads to more emergent properties than when you're playing solo. So the gap is wider. So I definitely think that if you're going in trying to get the same experience when you're playing with a group, you're just going to have a bad time, but in both directions. But if you embrace that it is something different, it's very cool. And it doesn't have to be, you know, some people say like, you know, aren't you, and these are never people who do solo playing, but some people push against the idea, well, aren't you just doing a journaling exercise or just writing a story? Why don't you just go write a novel? And some games are intentionally like that. You know, journaling, there are journaling games that are intentionally like that. And that's fine. But there is this other group. And you know, and then the other extreme might be like, well, why don't you just play a board game? Somewhere in between those two things, I think, is where solo role-playing is. It's, you have more creative freedom. So it is more of a creative exercise in a way than in a group because you have all the agency, all the creative agency. Mm-hmm. But it also is more structured than just writing fiction, because you have the opportunity to be genuinely surprised. And I think those are my favorite moments in the show and even stuff off the show, which is when I'm just genuinely surprised. Like I would say even in my last episode that I recorded, I thought it was going to go one whole way. And I was sort of preparing my mind for one set of things. And then the dice were just super like, no, that's not what's happening here. And so I couldn't push against it. It was like really like, okay, that's what the game and the structure that I've chosen is saying. It's no, you're going this way. And it was a total surprise. And that's something that's really unique and really cool, I think, with solo role playing. So
I would agree with that. With the latest post on my blog at the time this comes out will be a session I did based on the Omega Man, the old Charlton Heston movie. And I was playing through that, and I won't ruin how that ends, but you know, I didn't anticipate it would end the way it did, but you know, when I rolled the dice and that's what they say, And yeah. So that's going to lead us into oracles, because I'm using kind of my own cobbled together die system that if you go to the blog, you can see what I'm using, which may or may not be a good system. But one of the things I'm using in there is the idea that the dice can tell me, no, I'm asking the wrong question, and make mm-hmm. me reframe the question I'm trying to get the answer to, which kind of yeah. helps you shift. And you have to trust the dice in those encounters. Like you say, if you trust the dice, when they tell you no, ask a different question, then that can help you, as you say, be surprised as a player. And it makes a much richer experience than if you are driving, you know, because if you just change, no, I don't like that result, I'm going to take this one instead. Sometimes yeah. that's okay if you're doing a random table or something, but you know, you're coming up with a setting detail that, but even then, trying to react and incorporate these things in, it is a lot of fun. And I really like letting the dice answer those questions and being a slave to those dice most of the time. There are times maybe yeah. you're not going to go with it, right?
But yeah, occasionally I've done that where, yeah, random tables, I think you're right. A very, very, very occasionally you'll get just you'll spend about 20 seconds on it and you're like, and if you have enough time and you can come back to it or whatever, maybe that's okay. And you figure out like, how can I really incorporate that? Very occasionally there's a result that's just way too left field. I don't even know how, so I'm just going to move on. But I agree. And what really got me around to that was, I think one of the things that's popular with some of the more popular oracles is sort of the chaos factor or the sort of the meta factor there. And I forget where I first read this, probably some sort of a blog or something, but somebody was saying that, well, no, you already have inherent chaos. Maybe it was Ray Otis even with his oracle. But it was, there's already inherent chaos just by asking yes or no question without the probabilities there. So just embrace that. And that seemed crazy at first, but I actually really enjoyed that. And I think what really broke me onto the idea of you're asking the wrong question was parts per million has uh-huh. A bunch of rule sets. So I have, it's everything's blurred, but it doesn't matter. And it's audio anyway, but the Player's Guide to Solo Role-Playing, which is specifically for Cepheus Engine. And there was a spot on there that just, if you roll, it's supposed to feel like Traveler. So it uses the 2d6 like that. And one of the answers just says complication. And the description is the question itself isn't even correct. Your framing isn't correct. Do something else. And at first that seemed pretty wild. And that's taken some practice. But the more that I've done that, to your point, that is great, because that's an even better surprise than like, oh, roll the plot twist thing that's going to happen, which is fun. And I do that sometimes. But yeah, to take a step back and say, okay, your character has been trying to figure this thing out. Something else is going on. And you can just kind of pick whatever either the first thing or the first two other things that seem like they could be happening. And if you're really not sure, I'll sometimes roll to see which one it is. But yeah, I agree. And it's sort of a really short cycle between asking the question and getting the answer and moving on.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to, like you say, you don't want to dwell on it too long. And like you mentioned, 20 seconds, actually in that Tabletop Diversions, I had to play solo. He even bakes it down to like, you know, maybe 5 to 10 seconds. If you're just hitting a wall, then just move on.
Exactly.
You know? So you mentioned the parts per million. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I've actually got one of those pulled up because I wanted to mention that. Mm-hmm. We're going to go into different oracles here, but the neat thing about the parts per million oracles are, and you look at it, it's like, well, he's just got one for every different system. He's just trying to cash in. But what they're doing with the parts per million oracle is they're catering it to that specific system.
Right.
So like you mentioned, the Cepheus engine, you're using 2D6. The one for Unbelievably Simple Role-Playing for USR uses the D6, D8, D10 like that game does. So what the parts per million oracles do, and they may work for you, they might not, but if you buy one for the particular game system you're running, it is going to model using the same mechanics to some degree as your game system. So there's a synergy there, which is pretty nice. The negative is, well, I mean, you could use one of these parts per million or oracles for a system it's not designed for. You would just have different mechanics.
Right.
But if you want a universal oracle, it's probably not the way to go. But if you want one dialed in, if you know, hey, I'm going to play Cepheus for, that's my game, that's my favorite game, that's what I'm going to play, then I think it's worth picking those up, because if nothing else, it helps you integrate it in so it's a unified system.
Yeah, and I think that they're a really good way to go for a few reasons too, because you can always, and it's an intentional choice, I know, based on the discussion on drive-thru and so on, but you can always look with at the full Oracle. It'll say sample file all over it, so it'll be watermarked, but you can look at the full Oracle to see if it makes sense to you before you buy it. So I've certainly picked up several of those, because I also have the first one I think I got was the OSR Solo, which is really, really good, I think. There's usually some advice and stuff in there too, but I think when you look at a bunch of them too, you can kind of see it kind of helps teach you, okay, well, maybe there isn't one for the game that you're playing either. And here's how I would take there is sort of an underlying similar logic in general to how they work and how they incorporate with your game. So you could design one as well to fit with your game if you didn't have one already. So it's maybe not universal, but it has some universal underpinnings, I think, that you can apply. So it's definitely a good resource. They're worth checking out for sure.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Yeah. I've been really happy with them. So before we're getting into Oracles. We've been talking about Oracles, but again, you know, I rush these interviews and I'm not asking the questions in the right order. I think maybe we should back up. And when we're talking about an Oracle, obviously we're talking about using dice or cards or turning to a page in a book. We're using some kind of randomizer to come up with something for a story here. But what do you feel are, because you've used a lot of Oracles over the years and through the different seasons and playing at home, what are the basic components that you feel should be in a good Oracle? Obviously, there are all kinds of Oracles, rolling the D6, just being a yes, yep, no, to everything else. But, you know, what do you want to work? Like I've got three or four things I want an Oracle to be able to do. Mm-hmm. And so do you have like a set, certain things you want an Oracle to be able to do, or you expect?
Yeah, I think so. I think for me, it's a balance between how quickly I can ask the question and, you know, how quickly I can interact with the mechanics versus how rich of an answer I can get. And I think all of my favorite ones, even if it was just
James's internet dropped off. So I'm going to take a quick second to plug a Kickstarter. This is the Valley of the Pharaohs 40th anniversary edition. This Kickstarter is not being done by Palladium Books, but it is being done by the original author. If you're not familiar with Valley of the Pharaohs, it is one of the first products that Palladium put out. It was a role-playing game based in ancient Egypt, a fantasy ancient Egypt with magic and whatnot. You can buy the original PDF on drive-thru for like $5. But this is a print book. There will be a PDF included, but there's not a PDF-only tier. And it's greatly expanded. And it looks like a really cool project. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. You know, if it's something that interests you, maybe check it out. At the date this episode's dropping, you'll have about a week still in the Kickstarter to back this. So check out Valley of the Pharaohs if Fantasy Egypt sounds like something that's pretty interesting, or if RPG history, and especially Palladium Books history, sounds interesting, check it out. Okay, let's get back to the show.
Sorry about that, Jason. I have no idea what just happened there. My screen went dark. Technology has betrayed me.
No, it's all good. It's all good. We were talking about what you expect out of an Oracle.
Yes. So for me, it's a balance between how long it takes for me to interact with the mechanics and the richness of the answer that I get. So whether it's one that I've purchased or one that I'm just making up on the spot, this is always the balance for me. So I think richness versus time spent is one big balance. And then two, I like being able to have, I like to be able to be occasionally surprised by the Oracle. That's another big one. So some elements of surprise beyond just the randomness of it. I think being able to answer more than just yes or no questions. So being able to have something for the more complex questions are the best for me. And sometimes that just means kit bashing some things together, because some Oracles will have one or the other. So, I think, again, Motif was one that does well, I think, with the complicated answers. Doesn't always have Spark tables, so you might want other tables for that. I was doing something for a while with just some fate dice with different colors, so I could see, you know, positive versus negative, like that. But OSR Solo, I think, really got me onto, you don't have to have it be complicated to have that, because that one has a simple yes or no, but the second die, when it comes up on a one, that's when there's a surprise, and then you roll again on another table to see what the surprise is about. But then, and I think something I stole even from Geek Gamers, even if you have a good Oracle, but it doesn't have Spark tables, if you have a book that is of any kind of book, it is not a game book even necessarily, that is just in a similar fiction and you turn to a page and you pick a couple words, that's your Spark table. You don't even have to roll. You can just flip to a random page. I did that with, I think, mostly The Expanse, the first book of The Expanse, and then maybe the Engines of God, I think, was the other one, with the Jack McDevitt book. And just turn to a random page, grab some words off of that, and then you're good to go. So, but those are sort of the thing for me. I found personally that I've tried over and over to have the more structured oracles where you keep track of threads and characters, and that's fine. That's all well and good, but I've just found that I don't need the oracle to do that stuff for me because I can already do that. And a lot of times I even forget that stuff exists because it's just not relevant enough to the way that I play the game. So for me, I don't need that as much. I don't need the structure from that, but I want richness of the answers more than just yes or no. Now sometimes the game can fill in everything else and then just yes or no is fine, but yeah.
Great. So let's talk about some specific oracles, and I'm just going to kind of turn it over to you to talk about some of your favorite oracles and maybe the different niches they would fill if you're playing, why you might, for this particular day, you might grab this oracle instead of that one. Cause we're not necessarily saying there's one true oracle, that they're tools in your toolbox. And sometimes one is going to be better for a session than a different one is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think, and the biggest one for me, I think, is when it's specific versus generic, just like rule system. So I do think the parts per million ones are very good, or at least as a minimum, as a jumping off point. If it fits the game that you're playing, but otherwise for a generic one, motif is the one that I keep coming back to. And I don't even always use the additional parts. Sometimes I have, and some of those are my favorite sessions on and off the mic. But I think it's just that, because that mechanic is just so solid for me. It kind of reminds me of, you know, when I've been one of the few people banging on about Genesis every once in a while, because those dice have more than just yes or no. That's what I like about motif, is that die mechanic that you get yes or no, or sometimes yes, maybe, and no, depending on the question. And then at a minimum, you get how favorable or it is or not, or the degree rather. 1 through 6 is on the second die, is the degree to which is yes or no. And that's very often useful. And then there's different things that the third die can be. But for me, it almost exclusively ends up being how favorable it is or not to the party, because sometimes you can be surprised that it's a yes, and that sounds like it might be good for you, and it's extremely yes, but also extremely unfavorable to the party. And that tells me that, hey, there's something else. Kind of like, yeah, this is the answer to your question, but you're not thinking of the question right. Here's this other reason why. And for me, that's just such a solid thing. Plus, it does have, you know, it does have things about danger and stuff for NPCs. I haven't even used, it has a structure thing for NPCs. I've never even done that. I just roll on the tables occasionally. And it just uses a couple D6s. I like D6s. So so for me, that's probably a big consideration. If it's generic, for me, it's very often going to be motif. But sometimes in certain games, the yes or no questions aren't actually as interesting. So an example would be, I did a one shot with Explorers, and it was very focused on a space station. And at first I thought it was going to be much more like Deep Space Nine kind of stuff going in. It didn't end up quite being that way. It ended up being a lot more like there was like a hostage situation on it. Well, I guess that's kind of Deep Space Nine. That sort of stuff actually did happen, but the yes or no questions weren't as interesting. Mm-hmm. So I don't even remember. I honestly don't even remember if I used an oracle as much for the yes or no. But what I think I used was my own oracle, which can answer just yes or no questions with a card, and you just use the suit, you know, black or white, to say yes or no. But it was the other questions that were more interesting to me, the unexpected twists, and then the spark tables. And so that's kind of why I made that oracle, and I don't use it all the time for everything. I use it sometimes, but that is, I found that some people want just the yes or no questions. I'm actually much more interested in the complex questions. And so that's sort of why I favored that. Like when I was using other oracles and stuff that, you know, sometimes I would ask a yes or no question, but I didn't really care about that as much. I cared much more about the spark tables. And so I made the oracle basically just for the spark tables. So.
Yeah. So that's motif. What about? So I guess we should talk about the big dog in the room. Mythic is the one Everybody talks about. So let's talk about Mythic for just a couple minutes and your thoughts on the Mythic Oracle. And I don't know if you mess with the cards or just with the book
I just have the book. I just have the first book. I don't have the second one. It's a good Oracle. So I'm not avoiding to say like, oh, it's bad. It's very talked about, and that's fine. It's good. And there's a lot of supporting material for it. I think it's just that it's just like anything else, like with rule systems. It's kind of like talking about the big dog with like, oh man, everybody's talking about 5e, and some people want to just react, say, oh, that means 5e is bad. And I don't think that, but I think it does mean that we forget that there's a whole another world of stuff there. And it's the same with the oracles, I think. Mythic has the structure and it's good. And some people like all the bells and whistles. I tried to like all the bells and whistles. It's just, and I had good sessions with it for sure. And starting out, I would say it was useful, but I just found myself being, you know, sometimes surprised at like, oh man, I'm getting the chaos factor. Like it's just, I'm getting plot twists not very often. And that's really the fun part, or I'm getting them way too often. It's getting confusing. And so then that's when I realized like, well, I'm getting the same amount of chaos if I just ask a yes or no question and I don't assign probability. So that was for me, the big thing is like, actually, I don't love the granularity with the probability. It's not even the tables. I like referencing tables, but yeah, it was the probability part. So, you know, when Iron Sworn had that, you could assign is it more likely, less likely or whatever. It just had a couple degrees and that was much better for me. But then eventually I discovered that I wasn't really even assigning probabilities. Mm-hmm. If something was super probable, it just happens. Unless I really, really like, and unless I'm like saying, hey, this is almost a sure thing, but I still should roll for it. Then oftentimes I won't even ask it to the normal oracle if I really think it's weighted, and I'll just, whatever game I'm playing, I'll pick some sort of a die and assign a very unlikely thing. And like, okay, well, maybe it's a D20 game, maybe if I roll a one, then something crazy happens. But, and usually I don't even do that. If it's more likely, I think it usually just happens for me. And that doesn't fit everybody. But for me, I've been having more fun embracing not assigning probability. So that was kind of why I moved away from it, I think. That, and also I just wanted to showcase it on the show less, not because it's bad, but just because literally everybody uses it. So,
right.
Yeah.
So another oracle, now you've already mentioned Rayotis, and Rayotis has his oracle. It's on itch. It's free. I'll put a link in the show notes. So Rayotis's oracle was designed as kind of a slimmer, more sleek version of Mythic. Not necessarily to replace Mythic, but it's kind of to incorporate some of those same ideas, but in a much lighter weight package.
Yeah, I think that was really what showed me. That's where, when I really started moving away from Mythic, I tried that Oracle, and it's very good because I think it has all the best parts about Mythic for me without any of the stuff I wasn't really using as much. I think, for example, it was extremely insightful to have the chaos factor variability just be low, normal, and high, because that's really all you need. Because once you got past chaos factor, whatever, six or seven, like it didn't really matter when it was going from seven to eight. It didn't feel more chaotic, really. But it had that. It had some of the twists that you could do. So it really had the best parts for me. And, you know, and I think it seems like the second edition has a lot of the articles and stuff incorporated to me, and it was like a big tome, and that's fine. That was just too much for me. Like that was just going to be way too much. I was never going to use all those ancillary systems. And so I think that's even more stark now. I think that's a really, really good oracle. If you like the basic formula for Mythic, but find that you're using hardly any of it, then I think Rayotis's oracle is ideal, because it's the best parts, I think, of Mythic distilled down for me personally.
Yeah, no, I agree. I really like it. And he's got it set up. Like I say, you can go to itch.io. You can throw him a couple bucks, which I'd recommend you do, but you can also download it for free. He has a pocket mod of the rules, and you can just get the rules and put them on your phone. Or once you've used a little bit, I think you can internalize them enough to play it without having to reference a sheet as well.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
But the pocket mod is very cool.
Right. Oh, it is. It is, definitely. So another one I know you've used quite a bit recently is the CRGN. Or I'm sorry, yes. CRGE is what it is, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I kind of wanted to showcase that one some more. I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the author has sadly since passed.
Yeah.
But it's very good. And I started paying attention to it because it slots a similar niche, I think, for Mythic, but it takes a different angle. And certainly the other tools are really, really good. Like Une, especially. I haven't used it as much recently for some reason, but especially if you want to have really varied and intricate NPCs. The Universal NPC Emulator by the same author, extremely good, extremely good. There's also Bold for, like, I think if I were playing more of an open world thing, that's like more standard fantasy, maybe in a more populated region, maybe that I would use that more. That's for stories and achievements that people talk about. But yeah, it has a similar approach, but it sort of has, it doesn't have the chaos factor as much. It has sort of the surge count, which I think is actually even better for me in that way. And I think it's a better idea because really what's the chaos factor really for? It's like, you're tired of getting just yes or no answers and you want a more intricate answer, but you need to have the plain yes or no answers. Cause if every answer is special, the no answer is. So the surge count is every time you get just a normal yes or no answer, you add this number that adds to either extreme, up or down. It pushes you towards the outside. I thought that was really clever. And then plot twist, sort of, there's a list of 20 of them and have an explanation, and they kind of tell you, like, okay, here's the situation is changing, here's how it's changing. And then the way it splits the different probabilities is not by you assigning probability, but just, is it sort of the rising action of the scene, two knowledge, and then there's the conflict, and then there's two endings. And so it changes the probabilities to match sort of a narrative structure. And it's pretty subtle, that's pretty cool, I think. So I kind of wanted to showcase that one more, because if you're going to play an Oracle that uses a bit more structure, I think that's a really good one. And that one's underrated, I think.
Uh-huh. No, I would agree. Are there any other... obviously, there are a ton of other Oracles, but are there any other that you kind of want to highlight or talk about or point out to people?
I mean, that's the main ones, right? Because I've mentioned Motif as well, which, again, I think that one's extremely underrated. That's a good one. And we sort of mentioned the parts per million.
Yep.
I think that another good approach, too, would be to take the Iron Sworn Oracle just out of it, because the Iron Sworn itself is free. And if you like, especially if you like D100s, that's a good one, I think, to use as well. But I mean, you can even just really, another underrated option, I think, is taking some funky dice that you don't normally get to use and just having fun with them. So I've done that with, when I was playing Genesis, I just used the Genesis dice for that, or just some fate dice, you can use for that. But, I think that, and I think just finding a book and flipping to it for spark tables is super underrated. I totally stole that from Geek Gamers, the Geek Gamers YouTube. And that was really cool, because I had not expected that would be such a fun exercise, but it is. So that's probably what I'd say. I've heard people use Roria Story Cube. I don't really have any of those, but I'm sure that would probably be pretty cool too, where you roll sort of for symbols and then try to make sense of them.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, that blog I talked about, the Tabletop Diversions, talks about those, and they have a link on that blog. I'll put it in the show notes as well. I don't have it hand. I'd have to go through the blog and figure out where it is, but there's a link to a website that has a ton of these solo options built in the website. It's all web-based. So you can go there and it's got the story cubes. You can click and it'll give you story cube options. It's got other things you can click to get prompts, and I'll put that in the show notes. But basically, personally, I like to play solo with, again, we'll have to edit here, analog. I like to play solo, kind of analog without using maybe I'll use the computer type notes, or I'll have to have a rule set open or something. But usually I'll try to play with paper and pencil and dice and not actually using the computer. So I don't like looking up websites when I'm playing. But if you like using technology and the websites, this seems like a really good website, so I'll add that to the show notes as well.
And for what it's worth, I'm the same way, because I'm a software engineer during the day, and so I stare at screens all day, and I can't do it anymore. The day is done. I have to stop looking at screens. So I roll some physical dice and hold the paper, and I got the physical books. I don't use PDFs even to solo play. I can't get myself to do it.
Yeah, I guess the other one we should mention, because it is a really nifty, super simple one, is the one Matt Jackson uses. Matt Jackson hasn't put out some videos for a little while, but he has a system I talk about on my blog. I'll have a link in here to his video where he talks about it. But basically he has a red die, blue die, and a white die. And, you know, the blue die is yes, the red die is no, or vice versa. And then the white die, if you think something's more likely, you would just, that would count as an extra blue die or an extra white die.
Right. Yeah, that's another good solo play series too.
Mm-hmm. It is. And when you look at it, we talk about simplified systems. You know, he kind of uses white box fantasy adventure game, but then he boils the characters down to just one attribute, like their main attribute. So like the cleric has wisdom and, you know, that's it.
And right. And when you're playing a group, I think that makes complete sense. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, I highly recommend that, both Matt Jackson's blog and his YouTube channel. I'll put both in the show notes. So is there anything else you want to, obviously I'll put a link to your drive through page and to, and your itch and the show, Subclass Act. Anything else you would like to plug?
No, not really. I mean, that's the main stuff that I do. I keep wanting to do all these other different creative projects, but I just don't have the time for them currently. But yeah, that's the main stuff I'm working on. I would just say that the two, you know, as far as Oracles 2, all the books can be game books more even than normal, I think, which is cool. And you can, when you have the time, you can take the disruption for a second to go grab some other book that you wouldn't normally use at the table for a certain thing and roll on it. So like Perilous Wilds, I would say is like, and you got it. Like you basically have to have Perilous Wilds for me playing fantasy, but yeah, I mean, you can just roll on all kinds of things. I think another underrated approach too, I think even Runehammer has done this and talked about this before, is if you have a book and it's not even a game book, but you can just roll a D100 or similar and say like, okay, it's a 35. Okay, roughly whatever I think 35% of the way down the page, that's where I'm going to look, whatever that is. So even stuff like that, you can sort of gamify just things that you have lying around.
Well, yeah. And you know, it's interesting the way timing works. We have been planning to do this interview for, you know, maybe 2 months, a month or two. And, you know, something got in the way last time on my end, but the Twitter Pigs, which is a YouTube and a podcast, they just yesterday, as we're recording this, put out an episode about solo play and have a guest on there talking about solo play. And one of the things that I don't remember if it was mentioned in there or because I've been listening to a lot of solo play things. Maybe it wasn't, but it's interesting. The Twitter Pigs just released one and then this will be coming out. But I know in either on that show or it might be on a different one of the YouTube talks, maybe it was on Gamer Geeks or one of those or Geek Gamers, but they talk about using board game components. So the idea is grabbing, you know, if you got a favorite fantasy board game or fantasy card game, just grab those cards because there are flavor text on those cards and you could incorporate that as, you know, for ideas and things.
Yeah, exactly. Or just, you know, even illustrations and books, like what in the scene speaks to what I'm doing right now and how does that, you know, what would it be like if, and then insert whatever material. So yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And if you are a OSR player, if you're into those games, if you have Matt Finch's revised Tomb of Adventure design, that actually is all in one thing too. Cause one of the cool things about the new Tomb of Adventure design, not only does it have all the tables in the world in there for fantasy, but each page on the side of the page in the margin has those words, effectively spark tables on each page. There are words there, prompts you can use. So the Tomb of Adventure design, the revised one, the new one that was just Kickstarter last year, if you have that, you've got a great tool sitting there.
Yeah. And for that too, I think small books like Four Against Darkness has, you can use the dungeon generation tables from that. John Cohen from Tale of the Manticore also has a solo game, which I can't think off the top of my head what's called, but it has tables like that too for generating the dungeon because it's a solo dungeon crawling game. It's not as much a solo RPG, but dungeon crawling. But yeah, you can take those procedures are super good for generating a dungeon as well. So yeah, definitely.
Excellent. Well, I really appreciate your time. I want to be mindful of your time, but thank you so much for coming on the show. And if we get questions or anything, or can I reach back out to you to help answer?
Absolutely. This? Yeah. Always good talking to you, Jason. And my wife likes it because I can go get all of my nerd talk out a little bit, and then she doesn't have to hear it as much. So
excellent. Glad to help. Well, James, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Folks, that's all we have today. Thank you for listening. You can all the ways to reach James are in the show notes. The different products we talked about are in the show notes. I want to thank TJ for the music, Ray Otis for the clip art, and just ask everybody to be excellent to each other.
Your auntie or a joke about your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if I could shoot him dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. Is a dice man and more by a tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away, don't look away, don't look away, don't look away. Well, the zombies are arising and the world's gone to heck. We're living for the dying and we're dying for the train wreck.